Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Rabbi Jill Jacobs, CEO of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, who condemns the ICE killing of Renee Good and rallies with religious leaders across the U.S. to demand accountability and an end to ICE violence. Dr. Philip Landrigan, a pediatrician, epidemiologist, and director of the Program for Global Public Health and Common Good, who talks about the retraction of a study that found the herbicide glyphosate was safe amid new concerns about its link to cancer in weed killers like Roundup. And Commissioner Ana Gomez, the lone Democrat serving on the Federal Communications Commission, who condemns the FCC's dangerous use of intimidation and censorship that threatens Americans' free speech rights. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Not long after President Donald Trump ordered the U.S. military to bomb Venezuelan army bases and kidnap the nation's president, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife, Trump wasn't focused on narco-trafficking or political reforms, but solely on Venezuela's oil. This Latin American nation has the largest proven crude oil reserves in the world, but after years of political turmoil and harsh U.S. sanctions, Venezuela today accounts for barely 1% of global crude production. Less than a week after abducting Maduro, Trump summoned 17 oil company executives to the White House, urging a $100 billion investment to revive Venezuela's oil industry. While ExxonMobil CEO Darren Woods maintained that Venezuela today is uninvestable, Chevron remains the only major U.S. firm still operating in Venezuela. A year ago, Trump revoked Biden-era licenses permitting the oil company to operate in Venezuela. But after Chevron contributed $2 million to Trump's inauguration fund and spent $4 million more lobbying, the company won a new license to continue their Venezuelan operations. Trump recently announced that under the threat of a new U.S. military attack, the Venezuelan government agreed to turn over between 30 and 50 million barrels of oil to the U.S., the proceeds of which he'll personally control. It's uncertain how profits from a revived oil industry under Trump's control will benefit the Venezuelan people. During Donald Trump's first 12 months in his second term back in the White House, federal tax prosecutions fell to their lowest level in decades, declining more than 27% from 2024. Reuters reports that the administration has carried out a sweeping overhaul of U.S. law enforcement, forcing out scores of attorneys and focusing large sections of the Justice Department on the president's mass deportation of immigrants. The government estimates that each year, wealthy individuals cheating on their taxes results in a loss of some $700 billion. Criminal investigations and prosecutions seek to recoup only a small fraction of that amount, but the threat of prison or large fines is meant to be one of the government's key tools for deterring tax cheats. Experts, including former IRS and Justice Department officials, worry downgrading enforcement will embolden more tax cheating and a greater loss of federal revenue. A year after massive wildfires swept through greater Los Angeles, the scars and empty lots are still visible along the Pacific Palisades and in Altadena. 31 people were killed during the fires and more than 16,000 structures, homes, businesses, churches, and schools were destroyed by the out-of-control flames. While rebuilding efforts are underway, progress has been slow. Thousands of displaced Angelenos remain in limbo. In Altadena, a predominantly African-American community, outside investors bought up two-thirds of the properties sold. Manuel Pastor of the Equity Research Institute at University of Southern California observed, price pressure in Altadena has unfortunately made the neighborhood that was multi-ethnic become much more homogeneous in income and race. Given the fatigue, frustration, and financial hardship, many residents wonder if it's worth undergoing an arduous rebuild without knowing if the neighborhoods will bounce back. The Guardian reports that the people who made these communities special are already starting to slip away. Depending on who purchases the properties, LA's neighborhoods may undergo a major transformation. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
In the days following the January 7th ICE shooting death of Renee Good, the 37-year-old Minneapolis mother of three, thousands of city residents took to the streets to hold vigils in angry protests. There were a number of situations over the past 2 weeks where ICE agents physically attacked and arrested peaceful protesters as if their goal was to provoke violence and chaos. On January 16th, a federal judge ordered immigration officers in Minnesota to stop their suppression of peaceful protest. As Vice President J.D. Vance and Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem demonized Renee Good, blaming her for her own death, President Trump sent as many as 3,000 ICE and Border Patrol agents to Minneapolis, the largest federal immigration enforcement operation in U.S. history. Ratcheting up the tension even further, Trump threatened to invoke the Insurrection Act as he placed 1,500 U.S. active duty military on standby for possible deployment to the Twin Cities. In what many legal observers believe is a direct attack on free speech, the Trump Department of Justice has issued subpoenas to Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, and other state leaders for what they claim is an investigation into whether state officials conspired to impede ICE operations. Your reporter spoke with Rabbi Jill Jacobs, CEO of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. Here she talks about her group's condemnation of the ICE killing of Renee Good in solidarity with religious leaders across the U.S. who are calling for accountability and an end to ICE violence nationwide.
Well, this incident was obviously very shocking, that a woman who was in her car, who was just there to see what was happening, to protect her neighbors, was just, I think many of us have seen the horrible videos, was shot and killed. And she's not the only one. There are more than 30 people who have been killed in ICE detention or by ICE officers, as well as people who have been victims of other violence over the last year. So it is very scary and violent. And we've seen that ICE is just taking our neighbors off the street, not only people who have any criminal record, often without checking anything about a person, except maybe they hear them speaking another language, or maybe they just aren't white. And so we are in a very scary situation right now. And this is something that rabbis and the Jewish community feel very strongly about. Many of us remember that our own families are only alive today because we were able to come into the United States during a time when immigration was more possible. And we are also in the Jewish community, we just recently started reading the book of Exodus in the yearly cycle. And the beginning of the book of Exodus tells the story of how our ancestors were welcomed into the land of Egypt, were comfortable there, had a comfortable life. And all of a sudden, there was a change of heart. There was a new leader who decided that this foreign element was scary and decided that instead of welcoming our ancestors, that this pharaoh was going to oppress them. And so that story is very live for the Jewish community. And so we're really proud that our rabbis in Minneapolis have been out on the street. They've been doing Ice Watch. They've been donating. They've been collecting materials and money to support their neighbors and have been mobilizing their own communities. There was a very strong letter that came out from the Minnesota Board of Rabbis against the detentions that are happening. And this week, there is a day of action happening on Friday afternoon. There was a call for faith leaders from across the country to come to Minneapolis to join with local Minneapolis clergy. And so we have several dozen rabbis from around the country who are planning to fly to Minneapolis to join their rabbinic and cantorial colleagues in Minneapolis for this day of action. And I also want to mention that besides what's happening in Minneapolis, we have rabbis in Los Angeles, in Portland, in New York, really all over the country who are out on the streets protesting against ICE, trying to protect their neighbors, who are protesting against companies like Target that are allowing ICE to operate on their premises. And so we really have rabbis who, along with their communities, are active in states all across the country, as well as, of course, local Jewish communities and many other communities as well.
I wanted to get your reaction to what Trump is doing in terms of focusing thousands of ICE agents in Minnesota. He's demonized and criminalized a whole community there, the Somali community, really leveled just blatantly racist attacks on the Somalis living in Minnesota. Right now, there are 3,000 ICE agents there. Many people in Minnesota and Minneapolis believe it's a terror campaign to instill fear in the citizens there. And there's a threat right now by Donald Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act. And apparently he's put some 1,500 U.S. active duty soldiers on notice that he may call them up to deploy to Minnesota to confront or be aggressive towards the citizens there. Not long ago, Donald Trump said the most serious threat to the United States is, quote unquote, the enemy within. We're talking about some really dark future here if Trump is going to unleash the U.S. military on U.S. citizens. What are your thoughts about what's happening?
It is a really scary time. We saw that Trump ran his campaign both in this election and also in the past two elections, one that he won, one that he didn't, on fear of immigrants and on telling people that any problem that anybody might have, economic, social, et cetera, is all the fault of immigrants. That is a classic fear technique. It's a classic fear technique that is used by aspiring autocrats. And that's what Trump is doing. He is actively destroying democracy in this country. And unfortunately, we have many examples from across the world of countries that have lost their democracies, that have been ruled by dictators, by autocrats. And one of the steps that those leaders often take is to deploy the military against their own citizens. And this is a new step that he's taking. It's a very terrifying step. And it's the responsibility of all Americans to notice that this is a new move and to say really clearly that we're not going to stand for it. And of course, that's the responsibility of Congress and for all of us to keep our congressional representatives accountable to push back against all of these moves against democracy.
That was Rabbi Jill Jacobs, CEO of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. Learn more about faith leaders' condemnation of Trump ICE violence by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After a scientific paper was published in 2000 claiming that the herbicide glyphosate was safe to use on crops, U.S. government regulators permitted its application, mostly in the form of the weed killer Roundup, manufactured by Monsanto, now owned by Bayer. This despite the fact that glyphosate has been banned or its use highly restricted in many other countries. Late last year, the editors of Regulatory Toxicology and Pharmacology, which had published the 2000 study, retracted it, stating that, according to the New York Times, they learned that the company's scientists played a significant role in conceiving and writing the study, an inherent conflict of interest. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dr. Philip Landrigan, a pediatrician and epidemiologist who directs the Program for Global Public Health and the Common Good at Boston College. Here he talks about the problems with that scientific paper, how other studies have pointed to the toxicity of glyphosate, concerns that it's a carcinogen, and what, if any, new restrictions on its use he expects under the Trump administration.
Research on the hazards of glyphosate has been building now for several decades, including epidemiologic studies, toxicologic studies, and mechanistic studies, looking at the mechanisms by which glyphosate distorts cellular function. The epidemiologic studies have established a strong link between glyphosate and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, especially in people like agricultural workers and pesticide applicators who are heavily exposed to glyphosate over a long period of time. And the toxicologic studies have shown very clear evidence that glyphosate actually causes cancer in experimental animals when it's administered to the animals in their food and drinking water. And the levels of glyphosate that were given to the experimental animals were below, just at, and slightly above the acceptable daily intake. They were not sky-high levels, as people from the industry like to claim. That's simply not true. So on the basis of these findings, the back in 2015, so 11 years ago, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is the World Health Organization's cancer agency, determined in their very measured language, they said that glyphosate is probably carcinogenic to humans. And then since that time, additional epidemiologic studies have come along, additional toxicologic studies have come along. So that's the science side. I think the scientific record is quite clear that glyphosate is a toxic and a carcinogenic chemical. And we know that from national dietary surveys conducted in the USA that glyphosate is in foods that people eat, including breakfast cereals that are marketed to children. We know as a general principle, I speak as a pediatrician, that children are more susceptible to toxic chemicals like glyphosate than adults. So it's very worrisome that glyphosate is in the cereals that kids are eating for breakfast every morning. And we know that the glyphosate is getting into kids, into people generally, because CDC does rolling surveys through the American population, something called the National Biomonitoring Survey, and they pick up glyphosate and glyphosate's metabolic breakdown products in the bodies of a very high percentage of Americans today. And that wasn't the case 10 or 20 years ago. So on the disinformation side, Monsanto Bayer has orchestrated a campaign extending back over multiple decades now to argue that glyphosate is safe, that people shouldn't have to worry about it. And they have been quite successful. Glyphosate use has gone up almost exponentially since it came on the market in around the 1970s. It's become the world's most widely used herbicide. So it's an enormous market. So they've got a huge commercial interest here to protect. They've done multiple things to protect that market. They have packed committees at agencies like the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency with their scientists. And, for example, the EPA committee that included Monsanto scientists found that glyphosate was safe, in contrast to the committee at the International Agency for Research on Cancer, in which the Monsanto scientists were not allowed to vote. So that's one thing they've done. And then another thing that Monsanto has done, and this is the reason for the recent retraction, is that they have actually ghost-authored papers in the scientific literature that claimed glyphosate was safe.
One thing I wanted to ask you is there seems to be this growing split, at least for some members, of MAGA and MAHA, Make America Great Again and Make America Healthy Again, that some people in the MAHA movement would like to see this banned.
Yeah, there's clearly a split among the administration supporters on glyphosate, because EPA under Lee Zeldin is very strongly anti-regulatory. But the MAHA mums who have supported Robert F. Kennedy Jr. very specifically want glyphosate use to be at least controlled, if not banned. I read an article in this morning's Boston Globe that Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, who's from Maine, a very senior member of the House of Representatives, just managed to tap into the anger of the MAHA mums about glyphosate and get legislation through the House of Representatives, even in the current composition of that body, that is basically anti-glyphosate.
That was Dr. Philip Landrigan, a pediatrician and epidemiologist who directs the Program for Global Public Health and the Common Good at Boston College. Learn more about growing concerns about glyphosate's link to cancer by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Throughout his first term, and now after a year back in the White House, Donald Trump has launched frequent attacks on the media. The president has filed dozens of lawsuits targeting newspapers, TV networks, and social media companies, demanding millions of dollars in damages, and threatened to revoke the licenses of broadcast outlets that carry reporting or commentary critical of his administration. These intimidation tactics have often succeeded in causing some of the nation's most powerful media companies to surrender to Trump by paying out millions of dollars in settlements in frivolous lawsuits or being pressured to cancel programs like CBS late-night TV host Stephen Colbert and the short-lived suspension of ABC host Jimmy Kimmel until a major public backlash brought him back. Media mergers involving broadcast licenses, which require FCC approval, strengthens the ability of Trump to influence and potentially censor the content of vulnerable media companies. Evidence of MAGA political censorship can clearly be seen at CBS, which in 2025 was taken over by Paramount Skydance, controlled by Trump allies David and Larry Ellison. A segment critical of Trump, set to be broadcast on the CBS News magazine 60 Minutes in December, was canceled. And the new CBS Evening News anchor, Tony DeCoppel, has been widely criticized for kowtowing to the Trump regime. Your reporter spoke with FCC Commissioner Ana Gomez, the lone Democrat serving on the Federal Communications Commission, who was appointed by President Biden in 2023. Here she condemns the FCC's dangerous use of intimidation and censorship that threatens Americans' constitutionally protected right of free speech.
It does alarm me what this administration is doing to silence critics, pressure media companies into providing it positive coverage, and retaliating it against anyone that disagrees with. And this is inconsistent, to put it mildly, with our obligations to comport with the First Amendment and our Communications Act, which specifically prohibits us from censoring broadcasters. What this administration has done is it has weaponized any authority it has in order to control speech and control media. And the FCC has been doing this on its behalf. What we saw with the Jimmy Kimmel episode was just very public. But we are seeing this day after day after day, whether it's threatening reporters with jail time or threatening to revoke licenses or pressuring local broadcasters to preempt programming that this administration doesn't like. And it's important that we keep in mind that our actions at the FCC have to be grounded in the First Amendment and the Communications Act prohibition on censorship of broadcasters. What this FCC is doing is it is sending a signal to all the local broadcasters that it must air programming that it likes and not air programming that it doesn't like, or this FCC is going to retaliate against them. The FCC is using this vague standard that they call the public interest standard, which, by the way, there is a public interest obligation to the broadcasters to serve their local communities. The problem is the FCC is weaponizing that standard and using it very vaguely to mean anything it doesn't like. If a broadcaster broadcasts Jimmy Kimmel, then that doesn't meet their public interest obligations. So I'm very concerned. I'm very vigilant of this. This is why I embarked on a First Amendment tour, because I need everyone to see what is happening and to push back against this administration, because we don't want to see the fraying of our constitutional freedoms and the free press.
You know, given some of the alarming ways in which the Trump administration's FCC is attempting to censor political speech that it opposes, as we've talked about here, there's a natural tendency for people in broadcast media to be fearful about lines they might cross that could end their careers, get their media outlets in trouble, incur huge monetary fines that nobody can afford. Do you believe that media producers and news reporters, commentators, should respond to this new environment by self-censoring or consciously keeping, a low profile to avoid public criticism that could result their popping up on the FCC's radar and suffering penalties? I see a lot of this firsthand being involved in community media, where, our budgets are tiny, we're always on the edge of bankruptcy, and there's little or no capacity to hire, high-priced lawyers to defend themselves, ourselves. There's a lot of fear out there, and I'm wondering, in this very troubled time in terms of free speech and censorship in the United States and the role the FCC has taken, you accepting, of course, there's a lot of fear out there, and I'm wondering what your advice would be to broadcasters in terms of should they just avoid criticizing this administration until there's a new administration in power?
The threats are the point, because that is exactly what the administration wants. The administration wants to bring every reporter to heel so that it can tell viewers and listeners what it wants to tell, and there is no pushback. And that is exactly why we have freedom of the press, and that is exactly why it's important to protect the press. The press holds power to account. It's very uncomfortable. I don't enjoy it when I get probing questions from a reporter, but it's important that we respect that for our democracy. And you're exactly right that there is fear everywhere. The chilling is happening actively. And that is why I'm conducting this First Amendment tour, because I'm trying to inspire people to push back. Because if we don't push back, then what we are allowing is our democracy to fray, and we lose our constitutional freedoms.
That was FCC Commissioner Ana Gomez, the lone Democrat serving on the Federal Communications Commission. Learn more about how Trump's FCC is threatening press freedom by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, KIDE in Hoopa, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Nikita. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.